From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
Just a few days ago, we documented an attack which took place last Wednesday on the village of Blida, in which the Israelis used cluster munitions.
While Human Rights Watch is charging Israel with using cluster bombs in Lebanon, the Lebanese president says Israel's using the internationally banned weapon white phosphorus against Lebanese civilians, Dar Jamal reports from the hospitals of Beirut. Then in a U.S. broadcast exclusive, we bring you a wry Italian television documentary, Star Wars in Iraq, on the U.S. military's use of laser and other experimental weapons.
And now, all of a sudden, out of nowhere, you have a completely new physical principle being applied in killing people, in which they don't know that they're being killed because their skin and body is being heated by high-power microwaves, or they are being shot at by a laser, which would have an instantaneous effect.
And an Iranian dissident takes on Tehran and Washington. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The United Nations has launched an emergency appeal for the international community to help the people of Lebanon. This comes as Israel's bombardment of the country enters its 14th day. UN Emergency Relief Coordinator Jan Eglin said $150 million is urgently needed.
There is an explosive escalation, really, in the suffering of the civilian population. I would estimate there to be tens of thousands of new displaced and refugees every day now. All the schools in the entire country are now filling up, like this school, with desperate people who are fleeing from the bombardments. Has to stop.
The U.S. vowed to give $30 million, the aid package to help the Lebanese people, as a fraction of the $2.3 billion the U.S. gives Israel in military aid each year. The United Nations is warning the humanitarian situation in Lebanon will only worsen as the fighting continues. About 800,000 people have already been forced to flee their homes. 150,000 Lebanese residents have left for Syria. Food, water, fuel, and medical supplies are running out in parts of the country. The UN said entire communities have been cut off from the world because Israel has systematically destroyed the country's networks of roads and bridges. Meanwhile, Peter Bookert of Human Rights Watch has told Democracy Now! He has uncovered evidence Israel's fired cluster bombs at civilian populations last week in the Lebanese village of Blida.
In this one attack that we documented, one elderly woman was killed and 12 people were wounded from one family, including seven children. The husband of the family lost both of his legs, and I interviewed him in the hospital 2 days ago. So we're very concerned that Israel is using these indiscriminate weapons, cluster bombs, in populated areas is simply not acceptable and is a violation of the Geneva Conventions because these are indiscriminate and very, very dangerous weapons.
Peter Bookert of Human Rights Watch says the U.S. provided Israel with the cluster bombs in the past, but the ones used last week might have been made in Israel. We'll have more from that interview after headlines. On the diplomatic front, the United States is coming under increasing criticism for refusing to back an immediate ceasefire. Earlier today, Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice met in Jerusalem with Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert. He vowed the attacks will continue.
Israel is determined to carry on the fight against Hezbollah. We'll reach out for them, we'll stop them, and we will not hesitate to take the most severe measures against those who are aiming thousands of rockets and missiles against innocent civilians for one purpose, to kill them.
Rice also met with top Lebanese officials in Beirut on Monday, but they failed to reach an agreement. Secretary of State Rice said there would be no ceasefire unless Hezbollah released two captured Israeli soldiers and withdrew its forces approximately 30 miles from the border. The Lebanese government rejected the offer, saying they wanted a two-step process. First, an immediate ceasefire and negotiations for a prisoner swap, and then discussions to work out a solution to the situation in South Lebanon. Speaking in Israel, Condoleezza Rice dismissed calls for an immediate ceasefire.
If we have learned anything, it is that any peace is going to have to be based on enduring principles and not on temporary solutions. We will talk about how to get to an enduring cessation of violence, how to deal with the significant humanitarian problems that are currently facing the people of Lebanon.
Rice also suggested the United States and Israel is in the process of trying to reshape the Middle East.
We need always to be cognizant of and looking to what kind of Middle East we are trying to build. It is time for a new Middle East. It is time to say to those who do not want a different kind of Middle East that we will prevail, they will not. Thank you.
Meanwhile, at the United Nations, Syrian Ambassador Bashar Jaffe criticized the U.S. for failing to help end the bloodshed.
The American position now bypasses the Israeli position by its intransigence. So when Kofi Annan, for instance, calls for a ceasefire, the American ambassador to the UN says no. When the French calls for the establishment of a humanitarian corridor, the American delegate says no. When Kofi Annan says Syria and Iran should be involved in the negotiations for finding out a settlement of what's going on, Mr. Bush says no. There is a paradox. In my own opinion, the American diplomacy is isolating itself.
Bashar Jaffe is Syria's ambassador to the United Nations. The Guardian newspaper of London is reporting U.S., European, Israeli, and Arab leaders are expected to agree in Rome tomorrow on creating a coalition force to go into southern Lebanon under the banner of the United Nations to help end hostilities. But it remains unclear what countries will provide troops. CNN is saying that the United States will not provide troops. As discussions on the diplomatic front go on, Israel's assault on Lebanon continues. On Monday, Israeli Army Chief of Staff Dan Chalutz warned that Israel would bomb 10 buildings in South Beirut every time Hezbollah fires another missile into Israel. The Israeli Air Force struck about 70 targets across the country. Four UN peacekeepers were wounded in one of the attacks. Early this morning, an Israeli missile hit a house in the town of Nabatea, killing seven people. The death toll in Lebanon stands at about 400. Intense ground battles are also continuing between Israeli troops and Hezbollah fighters in southern Lebanon. Hezbollah also fired more than 100 rockets into northern Israel. 13 Israelis were injured. Meanwhile, in Gaza, Israeli shells killed five people. Hospital officials said the dead include a 60-year-old grandmother, her 11-year-old grandson, and a 4-year-old girl. Palestinians have called for a general strike and a day of rage today to protest Condoleezza Rice's visit to the region. Palestinian activist Omar Asaf said, quote, she is responsible for the killing of children in Lebanon and Gaza. She, her administration, and her policies are not welcome here. In other news, the latest round of trade negotiations at the World Trade Organization have failed. Analysts say this marks a serious blow to the Bush administration's international economic agenda. The French farmer and anti-corporate globalization activist José Bové hailed the news.
I think this failure first represents the failure of a system. The World Trade Organization has tried to integrate all human activities, including agriculture. But during the 20 years that agriculture has been integrated into global trade negotiations, they failed every time because the majority of the world's people refuse the idea that agriculture should be integrated as a commodity. The second reason of this failure is the selfishness of rich countries. The United States and European Union want to open southern countries' markets in the interests of their multinational corporations. This doesn't work anymore.
French farmer José Bové. In Washington, President Bush is scheduled to meet today with Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki. On Monday, al-Maliki warned Israel's actions in Lebanon will lead to further extremism in the Middle East. In Afghanistan, a senior British military commander says the country is, quote, close to anarchy. The warning comes from Lieutenant General David Richards, the head of NATO's International Security Force in Afghanistan. He said feuding foreign agencies and unethical private security companies have been compounding problems caused by local corruption. On Monday, hundreds of Taliban fighters attacked a government building in western Afghanistan. Three police officers were killed. Seven people were wounded. A new report from Human Rights Watch has determined U.S. forces are still abusing prisoners in Iraq as part of their standard operating procedure. The report was based in part on interviews with U.S. soldiers. Soldiers reported prisoners at one camp were regularly stripped naked and subjected to beatings, forced exercises, severe sleep deprivation, and various forms of degrading and humiliating treatment. On Capitol Hill, the Senate Foreign Relations Committee will be holding hearings on Thursday on the nomination of U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, John Bolton. Last year, President Bush gave Bolton a recess appointment after he failed to win enough support in the Senate. Democrats are expected to fight the nomination, but one of Bolton's top critics in the Republican Party, Senator George Voinovich of Ohio, says he will now support Bolton. In economic news, the New York Times has revealed the federal government is moving to eliminate the jobs of nearly half the lawyers at the Internal Revenue Service who audit tax returns of some of the wealthiest Americans. The cuts are specifically focused on estate tax lawyers, those who audit the taxes of the wealthy when they transfer their fortunes to their children and others. One veteran IRS estate tax lawyer called the job cuts a backdoor way for the White House to repeal the estate tax, even though the Bush administration doesn't have the support of Congress. In other news from Capitol Hill, the Senate is expected to vote today on a bill that would make it illegal for anyone to accompany a young woman across state lines for an abortion without notifying her parents. The bill is called the Child Custody Protection Act. Under the bill, a grandparent, a clergy member, or relative could face criminal charges for helping a young woman get an abortion. And in Ireland, five Catholic peace activists have been acquitted of damaging a U.S. fighter plane on its way to Iraq. The activists, known as the Pit Stop Plowshares, entered into Shannon Airport 3 years ago and used household hammers to damage a U.S. Navy logistics plane. They argued they had a lawful excuse for doing so, as they honestly believed they were acting to protect lives and property in Iraq. The activists faced up to 10 years in prison. Shannon Airport has been the center of anti-war protests in Ireland. On average, over 1,000 U.S. troops pass through the airport each day. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The United Nations has launched an emergency appeal for the international community to help the people of Lebanon. Emergency Relief Coordinator Yang Eglund said $150 million is urgently needed. A total of about 800,000 people have been forced to flee their homes. Food, water, fuel, medical supplies are running out in parts of the country. The UN says entire communities have been cut off from the world because Israel systematically destroyed Lebanon's network of roads and bridges. Meanwhile, questions are being raised as Israel violating international law. On Sunday, UN High Commissioner Louise Arbour told CNN Israel's actions in Lebanon could lead to the prosecution of its military commanders. Meanwhile, Human Rights Watch says Israel is shelling civilian areas with cluster bombs. On Monday, Democracy Now! Reached Peter Buckert. He is the Emergencies Director for Human Rights Watch, currently in Beirut. He began by talking about the humanitarian situation on the ground.
Well, I've been working in war zones for Human Rights Watch for the last decade almost, from Kosovo to Afghanistan and Iraq and Chechnya and Sierra Leone. And in terms of the dangers that we face out on the roads, this definitely qualifies as one of the most dangerous places in the world right now. It's very difficult to deliver humanitarian aid to the south, and villages throughout the south continue to suffer from heavy bombardment. We document case after case of civilian homes which have been hit in the south, where entire families have been wiped out. I mean, one of the issues I've been absolutely shocked about in terms of this conflict is the number of children who've been killed, because in almost all of the cases that we're documenting, we're talking about a civilian home which is hit, and the parents are killed along with four or five, sometimes six children, some as young as 1 year old. The youngest casualty that we've documented so far is 2 months old. It's very difficult to deliver aid to those villages in the south and in the Bekaa Valley, which are subject to the bombardment that we see. It's almost impossible for the humanitarian community to get the kind of safe passage guarantees that they need to be able to work down there and to get their trucks down there to deliver humanitarian supplies. And even ambulances have been hit in the south in the last few days. On the other side of the coin, it's also very difficult for civilians who are stuck in these villages in the south to leave their homes, even though Israel has ordered the immediate evacuation of all villages south of the Litani. We're talking about tens of thousands of people who are effectively stuck in this very active war zone. who are unable to flee because they're too afraid to travel on the road. On Sunday, we documented more than 10 cases of civilian cars which were hit in the south. More than 40 people were wounded and 8 or 9 people were killed simply for trying to flee to safety. So it really is a very, very desperate situation throughout Lebanon these days. Just a few days ago, we documented an attack which took place last Wednesday on the village of Blida, in which the Israelis used cluster munitions. Human Rights Watch has been very critical of the use of cluster munitions by the U.S. military because these are indiscriminate weapons. Basically, what they are is one big shell which opens up and drops a number of smaller bomblets over a very large area. Many of these bomblets don't explode, so they are effectively turned into mines. In this one attack that we documented, one elderly woman was killed and 12 people were wounded from one family, including 7 children. The husband of the family lost both of his legs, and I interviewed him in the hospital 2 days ago. So we're very concerned that Israel is using these indiscriminate weapons, cluster bombs, in populated areas. It's simply not acceptable. And is a violation of the Geneva Conventions because these are indiscriminate and very, very dangerous weapons.
Peter Buckard of Human Rights Watch also talked about the plight of Lebanon's refugees.
The Nations has estimated that there's up to 500,000 displaced people in Lebanon today. That's almost a quarter of the population of Lebanon. And I think those numbers are quite accurate. There's more than 100 schools in Beirut alone who've been packed with refugees. Yesterday, we visited an underground parking lot of a major shopping center where refugees are sleeping on two separate levels of the parking lot. And we go around on a daily basis to school after school after school, where every classroom has been taken over by multiple families. And they're not just people fleeing from the south, but also those from Beirut itself, especially from the southern suburbs, who have lost their homes in this very fierce bombardment of the southern suburbs, the Shia-dominated suburbs of Lebanon. I can't emphasize just how vast the destruction is in the southern suburbs. Walking around there is just a stunning experience. You're walking around and looking at these 14-story apartment buildings who've just been completely taken down, and you wonder what the military purpose Israel hopes to achieve by taking down these civilian apartment buildings. Certainly, there were in some of these neighborhoods some minor Hezbollah offices. For example, in one neighborhood we visited, there was a co-op run by Hezbollah and a political office. We don't think it justifies the kind of massive destruction that Israel is causing in these civilian neighborhoods of South Beirut. I think it's time for the international community to step in and to stop this onslaught on the civilian population of Lebanon. This is totally different from the kind of bombardment that we saw in Iraq and Afghanistan. Certainly, we documented a lot of civilian casualties in Iraq and Afghanistan when we worked there. But at least in most of those cases, we were able to determine what the specific military objective was that the U.S. hoped to achieve by these military strikes. In the case of Lebanon, it's very, very difficult for us to see, as Human Rights Watch, what specific military objective Israel is trying to achieve by bombarding the civilian homes in the south and the civilian neighborhoods of southern Beirut. It certainly seems very far removed from fighting a war directly with Hezbollah.
Peter Buckhart is Emergencies Director for Human Rights Watch. He was speaking to us from Beirut. Well, Human Rights Watch is accusing Israel of using cluster bombs. The Lebanese president, Emil Lahoud, says Israel is also using white phosphorus. Lebanese doctors have reported witnessing the effects of white phosphorus on their patients. Independent journalist Dar Jamal is in Beirut and has spoken to some of those doctors. We reached him earlier today.
Yesterday, I went to the Beirut University Hospital. It's one of the larger hospitals in Beirut, and I was speaking with the assistant director there. His name is Bilal Masri. And he told me, first off, we were talking about the casualty situation, and then this led into the white phosphorus situation in southern Lebanon. And first off, he said that they were receiving very many casualties there, mostly from the south, being brought in to them by the Red Crescent and Lebanese Red Cross, and that 55% of all the casualties in Beirut, according to Mr. Masri, were children 15 years or younger. He then said another startling statistic, that 30% of all the casualties are dying, and this was an extremely high casualty rate, that far higher than anything they saw during the Lebanese Civil War, meaning that of everyone hit, 30% of the people are dying outright. And I asked him why, and he said that it's because the Israelis are using these bombs that can penetrate through bomb shelters, that there's been so many refugees seeking shelter in basements or in bomb shelters, and the Israelis are bombing the bomb shelters. Warplanes are bombing the bomb shelters where refugees are hiding. And also that there was such a disproportionate number of children being killed and wounded because children, he said, were the least able to really escape when the bombing began. Children were the least able to really effectively run away and get to safety themselves. While we were talking, he said that it was actually confirmed by the Ministry of the Interior in Lebanon that the minister himself did confirm that the Israelis have dropped white phosphorus in southern Lebanon. And interestingly, just before I had gone to this hospital, I was at a refugee camp in a city park in downtown Beirut, and I interviewed an old man, a 76-year-old baker, who had told me that they fled Napatia down in southern Lebanon, which is the city where it is suspected that this white phosphorus has been used and where it was confirmed by the Ministry of the Interior. And this old man told me that they left because when the bombing there began, this was within the first few days of the attack, within the first week, that is, I'm sorry, that he left because his family was so afraid, because nearby where they lived, homes were being bombed, and inside the buildings and outside the buildings, they were glowing, as he described it. He said there were fires that, of course, we know what regular fire looks like, but this was not that, that the buildings were glowing. We were all very afraid. We didn't want to get anywhere near it, and they kept bombing, and so we decided to leave. But without a doubt, I think the most important thing that people need to understand right now is that the Israelis are using white phosphorus in southern Lebanon, and also it's been unconfirmed, but the Lebanese army is reporting that they are using dropping cluster bombs from warplanes as well, and other illegal munitions also, but that as of yet to be confirmed by an independent source.
Independent journalist Dar Jamal speaking to us from Beirut. After break, we'll talk about the illegal use of experimental weapons in Iraq. A new Italian documentary makes the charge. We bring you this U.S. broadcast exclusive. Stay with us. Samir Gibran here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. From charges of illegal weapons in Lebanon, we turn now to Iraq. In November, Democracy Now! Aired a documentary from Italy's Rai Television accusing the United States of using white phosphorus during its attack on Fallujah. Well, the same Italian team has produced a new documentary. It says the U.S. is now using experimental laser weapons against Iraqi civilians. Today, in another U.S. broadcast exclusive, we bring you an excerpt. It's called Star Wars in Iraq, produced by Maurizio Torrialta and Siegfried Ranucci for Rai Television.
They used incredible weapons, absolutely.
Experimental weapons?
Yeah, I think.
Yeah, they shoot the boss. We saw the boss as like a cloth, like a wet cloth. It seems like a Volkswagen. Big boss, like a Volkswagen.
This testimony was reported to American filmmaker Patrick Dillon a few weeks after the battle for the airport. The person interviewed, Majid al-Ghazali, is a well-known and respected man in Baghdad, who is the first violinist in the city orchestra. In addition to describing the battle, Majid al-Ghazali wanted to show Patrick Dillon the site near the airport where the mysterious weapon was used, along with the traces of fused metal still visible and the irregularly sized ditches where the bodies were buried before they were exhumed. We sought out Majid al-Ghazali to hear more details of his story. We met up with him in Amman, and he pointed out some inexplicable peculiarities on the bodies of the victims of the battle for the airport.
Just the head was burnt, and the other parts of the bodies wasn't anything happened on it.
Al-Ghazali reported that he had seen three passengers in a car, all dead, with their faces and teeth burnt, the body intact, and no sign of projectiles.
There wasn't any bullet. I saw they teeth, just their teeth, and no eyes. All of them, with the body, nothing for the bodies. Just the teeth and all the, the heads were burned.
There were other inexplicable aspects. The terrain where the battle took place was dug up by the American military and replaced with other fresh earth. The bodies that were not hit by projectiles had shrunk to just slightly more than 1 meter in height.
Except that the bodies is skulled by the bullets. Most of them that become very small. It's like that, something like that.
We asked Majid what weapon he imagined had been used.
1 year later, we heard that this is update technology. They used a unique one, it's like lasers.
We found another disturbing document on the use of mysterious weapons in Iraq, which referred to episodes taking place almost at the same time as those described by Majid al-Ghazali.
26 in the bus, about 20 of them, some of them have no head, the head being cut. Some of them, the arms, the legs. The only one who didn't injure was the driver. And really, I don't know how he reached our hospital. Because one hand, one arm was in his lap. One head beside him. It was a very, very strange, horrible thing. In the roof of the car, there was part
brain.
Of the body, momentum, intestine, brains.
Yes,
so
all parts of the body.
It was a miserable. It was very, 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 very miserable.
I told them before.
Do you have idea with what kind of weapons they attacked that bus?
This the bus, we didn't know what kind of weapon would be hit. Really, what we saw, cut arms, cut legs, cut head, abdomen, open abdomen, viscera outside.
It seems to be a new weapon.
It seems a new weapon.
They try to accept
it.
to do experiments on our civilian.
We don't know what was...
Nobody can identify what the type of this weapon.
We went to Belgium to find the filmmaker of the sequence, Geert van Murter, a doctor working as a volunteer in Iraq.
Here in this footage is taken in the hospital, the General Teaching Hospital in Hilla, which is about 100 kilometers from Baghdad and close to the historical site of Babylon. Here we had a talk with the colleague Dr. Saad Al-Faluji, which is the chief surgeon in that hospital. Dr. Al-Faluji said me that from the survivors that he operated, that they said they did not hear any noise. So there was no explosion to hear, no metal fragments or shrapnels or bullets in the bodies. So they themselves were thinking of some strange kinds of weapon which they did not know.
Let's hear Dr. Saad Al-Faluji's story about this more in detail.
In this pass, it was very crowded. They went to from Hilla to Kifil to see their families. But before they reached the checkpoint of American checkpoint, they returned back. They said to them, please return the villagers. They said to them, return back, return back. When he tried to return back, they shoot him from the checkpoint.
No gunshot wounds.
No, no. I don't know what it was, really. We are here, 10 surgeons. We couldn't decide what was the weapon which been hit this car.
But inside the bodies, you did not discover ordinary bullets.
All of them being... All, we didn't find bullets.
Yeah.
We didn't find bullets. But most of the passenger people... been dead, so they took them immediately to the refrigerator. We couldn't dissect and see. But those who are alive, we couldn't find any kind of shells. We didn't find shells inside their body.
Something cutting organs, cutting limbs, attacking the neck, attacking the abdomen, and goes out.
Dr. Faluji also ended up speaking about a laser weapon.
But I don't think the bombing and the cluster bombs and the laser weapons could bring democracy to our country.
As in any war, the war in Iraq left us a dreadful gallery of horror, images of mutilations that not even doctors can explain. The witnesses refer to laser weapons, arms with mysterious effects. We do not know what kind of weapons could produce such terrible effects. We tried to learn more about it by asking for interviews to members of companies manufacturing laser and microwave weapons. Yet, the US Defense Department prevented any information from being released to us. They also did not answer, up to the time the film was edited, the questions we had sent them in order to know whether or not experimental weapons had been tested in Iraq and Afghanistan. We tracked down the Pentagon press conferences from before the beginning of the Second Gulf War to see if they spoke about any new weapons being tested. The words of the Secretary of Defense and General Mayors indicate a willingness to try weapons that had never been used before. And the questions from the press about direct energy and microwave weapons made them visibly uncomfortable.
Mr. Secretary, can I ask you a question about some of the technology that you're developing to fight the war on terror, specifically directed energy and high-powered microwave technology? When do you envision that you can weaponize that type of technology?
Goodness. It is in, for the most part, the kinds of things you're talking about are in varying early stages. Do you have anything you'd add?
I don't think I would add much. I think they are in early stages and probably not ready for employment at this point.
In the normal order of things, when you invest in research and development and begin a developmental project, you don't have any intention or expectations that one would use it. On the other hand, the real world intervenes from time to time, and you reach in there and take something out that is still in a developmental stage, and you might use it. So your question is not answerable. It depends on what happens in the future and how well things move along the track and whether or not someone feels it's appropriate to reach into a development stage and see if something might be useful, as was the case with the unmanned aerial vehicles.
But you sound like you're willing to experiment with it.
I think that's the point. And I think, and it's we have, I think, from the beginning of this conflict, I think General Franks has been very open to looking at new things if there are new things available, and has been willing to put them into the fight even before they've been fully wrung out. And I think that's not referring to these two particular cases of directed energy or high-powered microwave, but sure. And,
yes.
And we will continue to do that.
But what is meant by direct energy microwave weapons? We went to ask ex-Colonel John Alexander, former program director in one of the most important military research laboratories in the U.S., Los Alamos National Laboratory.
The research and certainly the concepts for direct energy weapons go back many decades. What is happening is that the technology has now advanced sufficiently that we're starting to see the weapons come into fruition. In other words, they're becoming real. There are several types of directed energy weapons, and basically what they do is they are known as speed of light because they shoot electrons very fast over very long distances. Lasers, of course, are in the light range. Then there's microwave weapons that are operating at other frequencies, but basically they're beam weapons in which nothing physical goes out. The electrons move, but the kinetic weapons you talk about, you're shooting big bullets to go out and physically hit and destroy something. These work because the energy is deposed on the target and causes some effect.
These images document one of the TEL tests. TEL stands for Tactical High Energy Laser. In the sequence, you can see the laser beam hit and destroy missiles and mortar rounds as they are about to hit the objective. In this other test, we see the laser beam identify and destroy two missiles at the same time.
They don't make any noise and they are invisible.
Some are visible, some are, you know, just outside. You have, you know, in the infrared range. What's emerging now are laser weapons where the effect is that of the laser. And they can be hole burners, what we call very high energy laser, because with the concentrated energy, you can literally drill holes, you know, in a target.
Former Pentagon analyst William Arkin, who presently works as a journalist for the Washington Post, also confirms this revolutionary change from kinetic weapons to energy weapons.
For thousands of years, the way in which you've killed someone is you have hit them with a sword, a spear, an arrow, a bullet, a bomb. It's kinetic. You're killing them by hitting them. And now, all of a sudden, out of nowhere, you have a completely new physical principle being applied in killing people, in which they don't know that they're being killed because their skin and body is being heated by high-power microwaves, or they are being shot at by a laser, which would have an instantaneous effect.
There are other types of weapons made with lasers, such as the device we can see in the sequence. The target is not hit by a projectile, but rather by an impulse of energy that manages to bore through the armor of a tank. Apart from acoustic weapons, so far the only sign of the use of energy weapons in a war scenario is a laser device known as ZEUS. According to official Pentagon sources, military vehicles equipped with this laser device have been used in Afghanistan to explode mines or IEDs. According to two reliable military information sites, Defense Tech and Defense Daily, at least three such vehicles are being used in Iraq as well. And some people report having seen them.
When you showed me the pictures of what you described, that is a laser weapon, it reminds me that I was with American soldiers talking on in August 2003, and there was some kind of box on their tank with the blue light like this. I recall that very well, not because of the soldiers told me what it was used for, but because I was teasing a translator by telling, which was a female Iraqi translator, by telling, look, this is some kind of thing where they can look through and see somebody without clothes. That's why I reminded. But this kind of thing I have seen for sure on that tank.
William Arkin is one of the American experts who follows the Pentagon activity most closely. So what does Arkin think about the possibility of the use of direct energy weapons in battle in Iraq?
I can imagine that there could be some what we call black use of these weapons, but not in any significant way, and certainly not in such a way that one would conclude that they've had any impact.
But let's look at the Pentagon budget figures to see how important the outlay is for direct energy weapons.
So right now, you have about $50 million a year being spent on non-lethal weapons. You have about another $200 million or so being spent on high-power microwave, active denial-type systems. You've got probably another $100 to $200 million being spent on secret black laser programs. And then you've got the big lasers, the high-energy laser of the Air Force and the other tactical lasers. So probably, well, when you add all of that up, you know, the United States is probably spending $500 million a year right now on directed energy weapons, you know, probably somewhere in the order of 300, 400 million euros. So this is a significant amount of money. This is the size of the defense budgets of some countries in Europe.
That was William Arkin in the documentary Star Wars in Iraq, produced by Rai Italian Television. It was produced by Maurizio Tarialta and Sigfrido Renucci. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. You can see the transcript and view this and hear this again on our website at democracynow.org. This our U.S. broadcast exclusive of the Rai documentary. When we come back, Iranian dissident and investigative journalist Akbar Ganji joins us. Stay with us. Hello, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Renowned Iranian dissident and investigative journalist Akbar Ganji is on a month-long world tour to raise awareness about human rights violations in Iran. In April 2000, Akbar was arrested after he took part in a conference on political reform in Iran. He was released 6 years later, in March of this year. Since his arrival in the United States, Akbar has been speaking out against human rights abuses in Iran. He took part in a three-day hunger strike outside the UN aimed at forcing the Iranian government to release political prisoners. Last week, he declined a personal invitation to the White House to meet with top U.S. officials overseeing Iran policy. He rejected the offer, he says, because he believed that current U.S. policies could not help promote democracy in Iran. Akbar Ganji joins us now in the studio. Hussein Kamali also joins us to help with translation. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! It's good to have you with us. Akbar Ganji, welcome. Can you begin by talking about your investigations as a journalist in Iran in the late 1980s?
ببینید هر انقلابی که پیروز میشه در ابتدا پس از پیروزی انقلاب شروع میکنه به سرکوب مخالفین خودش.
Every revolution after it succeeds and comes to power begins to suppress its opposition. The opposition forces.
نگاه من معطوف بشه به این سرکوب‌ها و حذف مخالفین و اعدام اونها.
And from early on after the Iranian revolution, my interest, my attention was drawn to the fact, to the problem with these suppression of dissidents.
پروسه طولانی بین مخالفین که در اون موقع اول انقلاب اونها مسلح بودن و رژیم یک فرایند خشونت درگیر شدیم.
And in the beginning, the new regime faced armed opposition from various forces, and there was a period of intense violence from the state toward the dissidents.
رژیم تونست به سرعت بر مخالفین چیره بشه و اونها رو به شدت سرکوب بکنه.
And quite rapidly the regime succeeded in oppressing and suppressing any resistance and any opposition.
و در سال 1367 در تابستون چندین هزار زندانی رو در زندان‌ها اعدام کرد.
And in the summer of 1988 several thousand prisoners were executed.
بعد از اینکه تکلیف اینا روشن شد در دهه بعد شروع کردن بر روشنفکرایی که فقط کارشون قلم بود و هیچ سازمان سیاسی نداشتن اونها رو ترور کردن.
After that in the following decade they started to eliminate intellectuals and journalists and writers who had no intention to engage in armed resistance but only had their pens to express their opposition.
بعضی اینا رو کشتن، بعضی رو با چاقو تیکه تیکه کردن.
And they were slain in the most atrocious way. Some were cut into pieces with knives.
برخی از اینا هیچ گونه فعالیت سیاسی نداشتن، صرفا دگراندیش بودن.
And some of them had no political activities whatsoever. They were simply dissidents.
من وظیفه خودم می‌دونستم که اینجا برخورد بکنم به عنوان یک روزنامه‌نگار، به عنوان یک ناراضی سیاسی.
As a journalist and a dissident, I decided to get involved with this.
شرایط بسیار سختی بود که ما درگیر بودیم و این قتل‌ها رو افشا کردیم.
It was a very difficult situation and we exposed these killings.
حداقل افشای ما باعث شد که اون قتل‌ها دیگه ادامه پیدا نکنه.
To say the least, what we did in writing about the killings stopped their continuation.
اما این خواست ما که کمیته حقیقت‌یاب تشکیل بشه و کل حقایق اون قتل‌ها افشا بشه و محاکمه بشن چنین چیزی نشد.
However, the demand to form a truth-finding committee and to find out the root causes and the full reasons for committing those crimes was never it never came to pass.
و کسانی که عاملان این قتل ها بودن قصر در رفتن.
And the people involved in the killings just got loose.
دوست من آقای حجاریان ترور شد دوباره بعد از این جریان و ما همه زندان افتادیم.
After this my good friend Saeed Hajjarian there was an attempt to kill him and the rest of us we went to prison.
و به جای اون که اون قاتلان محاکمه میشن ما همه لطوپار شدیم، یکی سعید فلج شد و ماها سالها در زندان افتادیم.
And instead of the killers we were persecuted. Saeed Hajjarian is now paralyzed and sits on a wheelchair and the rest of us had to go to prison.
Your investigation, Akbar Ganji, pointed the finger at the highest levels of the at the time the Khamenei administration of Iran.
به گمان من مسئولین بلندپایه نظام تو این قتل‌ها دست داشتن.
In my view, high-ranking regime officials have been involved in the killings.
من در دادگاه کنفرانس برلین که محاکمه شدم اسم بسیاری از اونها رو بردم.
When I was put on trial for participating in the conference at Berlin, I named several of those high officials in my court.
اونها هیچ موقع منو به خاطر قتل‌ها محاکمه نکردن.
But they never put me on trial for writing about the killings.
چون اون پرونده انقدر کثیف بود و غیر قابل دفاع که اونا میترسیدن من در دادگاه حرفایی بزنم براشون بد بشه.
Because that file, that dossier is so tainted and so problematic that they are scared that if I talk, so much will be exposed.
به جای اون منو متهم کردن که اسرار سری نظام رو برداشتم.
Instead they convicted me of having divulged state secrets.
منظور از اسرار سری نظام همون قتل‌های زنجیره‌ای بود.
And of course state secrets were they meant by that my exposition, my exposé of the killings.
18 ماه به من زندان دادن به خاطر سخنانی که علیه آقای خامنه‌ای گفته بودم.
And also they gave me a sentence of 18 months in prison because of what I had said against or about Mr. Khamenei.
We're talking to Akbar Ganji, an Iranian dissident and investigative journalist, translated by Hossein Kamali. You have just won in this country the International Pen Prize for your investigative journalism. You also were invited to the White House to talk about the situation in Iran as a leading political dissident there. You refused. Why?
من از اول این سفر که آغاز کردم به کشورهای غربی در کل اروپا و آمریکا دعوت شدم با سران این کشورها دیدار داشته باشم.
From the beginning of my trip to the West in Europe and in the United States, I had invitations from various heads of state and government officials to meet with them.
من کلیه این دعوت‌ها رو رد کردم.
But I declined all such invitations.
کار ما با مونیک روشنفکر کار جامعه مدنیه.
As an intellectual, I'm interested and I'm involved in the civil society project.
ما با روشنفکران به نام جهان و روزنامه‌نگاران و نهادهای مدنی دیدار کردم.
I engage in discussions with intellectuals and representatives of civil organizations, non-governmental organizations.
من با هابرماس، آنتونی گیدنز، دیوید هلت دیدار کردم.
I met with Habermas, Anthony Giddens and David Held.
فردا با نوام چامسکی دیدار دارم و جمعه با ریچارد رورتی.
Tomorrow I'll be meeting Noam Chomsky and on Friday I'll be meeting Richard Rorty.
ما به دولت‌ها اطمینان آنچنانی نداریم.
We do not have much trust in governments.
فکرم نمی‌کنیم مسئله اینا دموکراسی و حقوق بشر باشه.
And we don't really believe that their interest is in promoting democracy and the cause of human rights.
شما الان می‌بینید بنیادگراهای مسیحی، بنیادگراهای یهودی و بنیادگراهای مسلمان منطقه خاورمیانه رو به آتش جنگ کشیدن.
We can see what Christian, Jewish and Muslim fundamentalists have perpetrated in the Middle East by promoting war.
هم مسیحی هم مسلمان هم یهودی و ما در مقابل داریم بیرق صلح تو جهان بلند میکنیم.
On the other hand, we are raising the banner for peace in the world, unlike the Muslim, Christian and Jewish fundamentalists.
یعنی میخوایم صلح طلبان ایرانی و با صلح طلبان آمریکایی و کل اروپایی پیوند بینشون برقرار کنیم.
Our intention is to bring together the anti-war forces within Iran, from Iran, and from the rest of the world together.
Akbar Ganji, the U.S. has threatened to attack Iran. The president, President Bush, has called Iran a part of the axis of evil. What does this kind of pressure, what is your response to this kind of pressure on the Iranian government that you too fiercely criticize?
ما به شدت مخالف حمله نظامی به کشورمون هستیم.
We strongly oppose any military invasion against our country.
حمله به صورت عراق و افغانستان به ایران امکان پذیر نیست.
First, it is impossible to invade Iran in the same manner that Iraq and Afghanistan were invaded.
حتی اکثر کاری که اینا میتونن بکنن اینه که از دور با موشک‌های بالستیک یا بمباران مراکز زیربنایی ما رو بزنن.
Most they can do is to launch missile attacks from afar. or to perform pinpoint operations against
این کار دموکراسی درست نمیکنه.
But this will not bring democracy.
فقط باعث میشه که کشور ما نابود بشه.
It will only devastate our country.
معلوم هم نیستش که از این راه حکومت خودکام از بین بره.
And it's certainly not clear that this would bring down the tyrannical regime.
دموکراسی رو به هیچ وجه نمیشه از راه حمله نظامی یا تصویب بودجه 75 میلیون دلاری صادرش کرد.
Democracy cannot be exported with the use of military invasion or with 75 million dollar budgets.
وضعیت تأسف‌بار عراق برای همه بسته.
The sad situation we witness in Iraq is certainly more than enough.
ما دنبال خط سومیم.
We follow a third line.
خط سوم نه به سیاست خارجی دولت آمریکا و سیاست‌های دولت ایرانه.
And the third line says no to American foreign policy and says no to the policies of the Iranian regime.
ما دنبال صلحیم.
We are anti-war. We speak for peace.
و برای صلح باید نظام سیاسی کشورمون هم دموکراتیک بشه.
And in order to bring peace, we need the system in our country to become democratic.
اما این دموکراسی رو ما باید ایجاد بکنیم.
However, we are the agents of bringing that democracy, not the United States.
پرزیدنت بوش و بلر اعتراف کردن که طی قرن گذشته تمام حکومت‌های خودکامه رو تو منطقه دول غربی سر کار آوردن.
President Bush and Mr. Blair have already admitted that these tyrannical despotic systems have been put in place by the West.
امروز هم که به اشتباه خودشون پی بردن میخوان راه نظامی مشکل حل کنن.
And even today that they have realized their past mistake, they intend to solve it by through a military solution.
این مشکل راه حل نظامی نداره.
But there is no military solution to the problem.
How can you bring democracy to Iran? How can the pro-democracy movement in Iran be empowered?
جنبش وسیع دموکراسی خواهی تو کشورمون داریم.
We have a widespread democratic movement within our country.
این جنبش دو تا نقطه ضعف اساسی داره.
There are two main weak points for this movement.
جنبش ما اولا سازمان و تشکیلات نداره.
First is the lack of organization.
و رهبر هم نداره.
And there is no leadership.
ما نیاز داریم که این جنبشمون رو متشکل بکنیم.
We need to better organize the movement.
و یک رهبری شبیه گاندی به طور دموکراتیک براش انتخاب کنیم.
And to elect democratically a leader for this movement, a leader like Gandhi.
اگر این کارو بکنیم میتونیم خیلی سریع به پیروزی برسیم.
If we can manage to do this, the road to victory is short.
اما به یک نکته شما باید توجه داشته باشید.
But we should bear in mind at least one point.
تو کل منطقه خاورمیانه در هر کشوری امروز انتخابات برگزار شه، بنیادگرای مسلمان پیروز میشن.
Wherever in the Middle East a free election is held, Muslim fundamentalists will inevitably win.
غیر از مشکلات ساختاری که این منطقه گرفتار شه، سیاست خارجی غلط دول غربی هم تو این کار موثر بود.
In addition to fundamental structural problems, also Western foreign policy is responsible for this.
ایران تنها استثنای این منطقه است.
Iran is the only exception in the region.
ایران اگه یک انتخابات آزاد توش برگزار شه، نیروهای مدرن و دموکرات توش پیروز
شه. Should there be a free election in Iran, the winner will be democratic and freedom loving forces.
اما این نیروها میونه چندان خوشی با سیاست خارجی دولت آمریکا ندارن.
But those parties look at US foreign policies with suspicion.
You are holding a protest for women in Iraq
next.
وضعیت زنان تو ایران خیلی تأسف‌باره.
The situation of women in Iran is grave and a matter of serious concern.
اونا از دو گونه ستم رنج می‌برن.
They suffer from two kinds of injustice.
یکی ستمی که حکومت خودکامه به همه مردم روا می‌داره.
One, the injustice perpetrated by the tyrannical system equally to everyone, to every
و دوم ستمی که به خاطر زن بودن بر زنان ما روا داشته میشه.
And then the injustice perpetrated toward them because they are women.
در قانون اساسی ما زنان از بسیاری از حقوق محرومند.
In the Constitution of the Islamic Republic, women are deprived of several fundamental rights.
همینطور در قانون مدنی و قانون مجازات اسلام.
Also in the Civil Code and in the Islamic Penal Code.
رضا شاه به زور زنان ما رو بی حجاب میکرد، حکومت جمهوری اسلامی هم به زور زنان رو با حجاب میکنه.
Under Reza Shah, the veil was removed by force. And under the Islamic Republic, they are forced to wear the veil.
And when will that protest be?
این حرکت اعتراضی کی خواهد بود؟
من دارم هماهنگ میکنم با داخل کشور و خارج کشور طی یک دو هفته آینده.
I'm negotiating with forces within and without the country, and it will take place within the next two weeks.
Akbar Ganji, I want to thank you very much for joining us. Iranian dissident, investigative journalist, held in Iran for years in prison and tortured, now speaking out in this country, refused an invitation by the White House. Translated by Hossein Kamali. I want to thank you both for being with us. And that does it for our broadcast. Our website is democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Berkshire, Fodo Kadus, John Hamilton, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Richin, Frank Lopez, Aaron Mate. Special thanks to Uri Galed, Angela Alston. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.